This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So we talked many times over the years, Marjorie and I, and we talked last night, and we came up with some notions of things to say, but of course, there's been so much said today that it seems I have a number of things I'd just like to pick up on. Mm-hmm. And you must be actually bursting with either rejoinder or nuance or who knows. But I mean, having been had this much said about you and you being perfectly silent seems like an incredible asymmetry. So, just one other thing, just maybe to frame this, and this frame may be totally fictional. But Francine, I went to see Marguerite's show earlier this spring. The last afternoon was up, and actually Marguerite was there. And we launched in, you know, within 25 seconds, the most fascinating conversation, which is one of these pure idealized fictions that neither one of us can quite remember what she said. But really, within 20 seconds, Marguerite was saying there are three kinds of abstraction. And I asked her last night, I said, Margaret, I really want you to say that. She said, I can't remember what you're saying. You've remembered.
I've misremembered the following. But as you know, when one is manic, for good or ill, the first thing that goes is memory, in the sense that one is so caught up with the force of what one is trying to say. But it went something like this. However, I forget what provoked it. So now that I'll say something, and you have to devise
your paintings, and
you'll have to devise the question.
You started talking about a conversation that you and Norma had about paint samples. And this has been brought up a few times, about yellow, the notion of the color yellow standing in actual maelstrom of perception, usage, physicality.
Okay. Let me start with that. But the sort of the three kinds of abstraction may have been a historical, in response to a historical situation I was trying to get at. Norma and I don't know each other well in a certain sense, but we know each other deeply. On one of the first times we met, we had a conversation in which my paintings came up, and I said I had given myself a painting problem, or formulated a painting problem specifically for realization during a studio grant, and that problem was indicated on a piece of paper that I still have. I put two yellows on a piece of paper and said to myself, think about this for a year. And Norma took out of her wallet a color sample of gray, and two grays, and so we knew we had a lifetime of conversations ahead of us.
We're already in process
without our knowing it. And that we were just late in catching up on the conversation. The little thought piece that I wrote in dialogue with Norma that's on the website is, however, that dates, that is to say, mentally dates from earlier than that, when I was, amongst other things, teaching Wallace Stevens and thinking about what other kinds of entities come into being when we name something by a color. And sometimes it's perceptual, sometimes it's conceptual, sometimes it's pragmatic. It seemed to me profoundly a problem of knowledge, which I have only begun to think about. For instance, one of those little poems on the website consists of Cézanne's yellow palette. Now, what kind of a name is that when the spectrum of yellows is not exactly perceptual, it's conventional, And it reflects at the same time a personal spectrum. Whose authority to enter into the discourse of discussions about the spectrum is proved by the conceptual heft of Cézanne's own realizations. At any rate, there are other kind in, within that poem on the website, it's not that I want to cite that particular poem, but I'm leading to a sort of a discussion of lists or groups of threes and things like that. There are, for me, the working out of series, the conceptual basis of which differ. They may not differ in terms of logic. They may differ in terms of knowledge, of certain kinds of provisional forms of knowledge, not necessarily logical. At any rate, so the paintings that you were seeing and that I was coloring you about...
Coloring
or coloring? Coloring. Had in part... two of them, anyway. Incorporated some of that thinking on the deferring of... the name or the occupation of the name or the competing or the contesting aspect of a category distinction by two things, two material entities which have a perceptual basis but I see more as either a problem of knowledge or a problem of formal logic or depending on one's description, of course, and this is where descriptions have unseated definitions. At any rate, now I'm getting up on my hind legs. I remember this very well in the gallery. And it's all coming back. And in terms of the, I don't know if one could draw different genealogies, but one credible genealogy to the Museum of Modern Art in New York, a very interesting institution, a very fortunate institution in having Alfred Barr, as young as he was, the first director. Fortunate because before he knew he was going to be director, in fact, he was doing his graduate work in Europe, and his roommate, Yair Albert, said, "You must go to Russia. You must, while we're here, go to Russia." As a result of that, as a result of a mania that wasn't very well disposed to conversion experiences. Alfred Barr's Museum of Modern Art was a museum of at least three modernities. And he's not given enough credit for, in other words, it was differentiated at the start. So not all the terms were equally privileged. The museum as an institution is based on the Bauhaus with the design principle that was going to design, not in the weak sense, but the design principle as the comprehending principle for all technique, technologies, painting and sculpture, whatever, architecture. And one could go on about that. The French and the Bauhaus would, if not exactly... synthesized perfectly, would attempt, of course, we've come to view this with some skepticism, but even that can be thought about more thoughtfully, attempting a universal language, or at least an alphabet, of design principles in the Bauhaus that might, in fact, if not unite all the arts in some sort of simplistic way, at least... address the question of visual literacy and of some potential grammar in virtue of that. But the Museum of Modern Art is also informed through the constructivism and productivism, surprisingly enough, when you think of Barr's patrician education at Harvard, informed by his conversations with Rodchenko, with whom he disagreed heartily, but whose conversations he recorded in his own diaries, as well as Eisenstein, Meyerhold. Can you imagine this? And it was Barr who came back with 42 children's books, who came back with Kino magazines intact. This is not a tourist of the imagination. And he's not given enough credit, I would maintain, even though, again, the ideological bias of the West is French, and that's the one that prevails in the galleries. There's nonetheless, there are many artifacts of first importance. White on white? That's not somebody who didn't know what he was doing. And so I would maintain the Museum of Modern Art is a museum of modernities, and the French, the German, and the Russian. And I think I may have been babbling on about that at that time.
There's a number of things I'd love to ask you about. Thinking about universal language, we talked about this a little last night, and you used two phrases, universal language and then visual literacy. And last night we were talking about grammars, and I was saying I would love to hear you talk about your sense of your grammar or syntax of poetry versus that of painting and what differences there might be between them. So that's one. So universal language implies something that actually speaks articulately to the senses, I would think. A universal language. Everybody can process it. Everybody can process it. As opposed to visual literacy, which applies pedagogy and learning and histories, and you could be visually illiterate, even though you're sighted. The distinction to ask what is what is the substance of your art in the two arts, painting and poetry. I'm thinking of both Oswaldo this morning and Joseph saying not painterly. Your painting isn't about paint. So is the substance in art, is it paint, pigment, or is it history, art? You know, the history of the art. Mm-hmm. Is one question. Then what would be the substance in writing? But
Let's see if I can slog my way through some of this.
That's what.
Okay.
In the beginning.
This will raise more questions than it answers, even to myself. Universal doesn't mean a head count in which everyone is polled and found to be understanding a certain body of knowledge all in the same way, univocally. There can be legislated commonalities, which we sometimes call language, sometimes law, sometimes ethics, which may not be literally true and may not even be true in even most pragmatic senses, but it helps coordinate things.
Conversation, hospitality, there's other...
No, but I mean, much life and death, for instance, rites of passage, those are universalities by which we take stock, or at least culture believes it needs to take stock in certain cadenced ways with mortal outcomes one way or the other. Now, I'm not much of an anthropologist, but I do note that there are hypothetical universalities that we are educated to just as much as the visual literacy. And that's where I would give a course correction to what you were saying, though you would be the last person to think that language is somehow natural. But I just want to say that, you know, verbal language and visual language are taught you know, that's just human cultures are predisposed to emphasizing speech and writing over visuality is not necessarily the way every culture manifests itself. Some are numeric cultures. Some are musical cultures. Some are philosophical cultures. Actually, I think more should be made of the differences of those universalities. I think those are very precious languages, and were they to be lost, we would be very sad collectively. But getting back to the painting, genealogy or history is maybe a minor topic. What was said several times today, I feel more comfortable with. That is to say, I'll formulate it this way. There is a historical component to the propaganda I tell myself about my paintings. But I think of them in problematic terms. Then the problematic goes something like this. There are certain commonplaces about modern painting. Red, yellow, and blue, believe it or not, is a nexus that's one of them. Rodchenko did, when he did his last paintings before he went into advertising, before he actually helped develop graphic design that is very intrinsic to advertising, really. He did a red, yellow, and blue painting. Mondrian's conceptual configuration of red, yellow, and blue is very different, utterly different. Some people might argue it is non-material, whereas Rodchenko's was utterly material. Nonetheless, Mondrian concentrated on red, yellow, and blue. Barnett Newman, whose conference is down the road today, after a hiatus in which he had given up painting because he knew enough intellectually to know that merely being in one studio was insufficient to call oneself an artist or anything, until one had a problem and a stance toward the paradigms of cubism and surrealism. When he returned to painting, he settled on red, yellow, and blue. I consider that a modern commonplace. It's an example of a modern commonplace. So I say to myself, whatever I call myself, I am now responsible for a question that goes something like this. What would a red, yellow, and blue nexus or little formal framework look like to a post-structuralist or to a postmodern or to someone whose language already entails those things? That's how I think about painting, the same with certain kinds of syntax. The series is one syntax, is red, yellow, and blue a series or is it a sequence? Well, it depends sometimes. But you can see how that might change depending contextually on the problematic at a certain R2-D2, time T, you know, space D, culturally speaking. I mean, you think about context an awful lot, and you would know that that's, you know, instantly that's true. So that's how I tend to think of my...
It seems like an extraordinarily clear sense of a universal task and contemporary task, necessary task of a painter, as you see it, for yourself to be a painter. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, I carried around the two yellows in my... Did you say? You carried them around for a year, mm-hmm. thought about them for a year. Strikes me as an analogous initiatory gesture to Newman, you know, somehow to really gain a kind of artistic maturity, you have to go outside, routinized productivity, figure out, get something basic figured out, and then you come back.
That's one way of doing it, and there are other ways of doing it. For instance, I hope I'm not misstating this too much, but the idea for originality in certain cultures that practice calligraphy is this, that you become original insofar as you have assimilated the principles of calligraphy and have internalized them. Then what you do is obviously original through that assimilated knowledge. It can be intuitive, but in fact, the intuition is that knowing that can perform intelligently once something is assimilated. And that's a kind of originality. The reason I bring that up, aside from the fact that to say originality these days is a red flag, but is to say that when you were saying universal project comprehend, there are other modes of that comprehension. That's one mode that I'm comfortable with, but there are other modes.
I'm trying to remember who quoted, somebody here quoted Valerie or Rorty, that nuance and originality, you can't be nuanced and original, isn't that?
Which is
rigor and original, okay. You can't be rigorous and original. You're actually saying quite the opposite, I would think.
Yes.
Right. It's good. It's always good to say the opposite of what you think.
No.
I mean, you know, it's not done often enough. How about in poetry? Can you give us a sense of some sort of self-instructional scene equivalent in poetry?
Or
a problem that you needed to really get clear and do harder, I would think.
It is, but one of the projects, as you know, and I've been quite pedagogical to myself with it, is though I hope to outgrow this someday, is to think.
Whatever this is. I'm sorry, I'm interrupting. Go ahead.
The lyric, epic, and drama are genres which are institutionalized in certain respects, culturally, they've been culturally profiled. Let's put it that way. The question that I have posed to myself now and then has been that if it is true that for about 50 years, depending on one's narrative, writing in general, the term writing has in fact assimilated a gradient of intellectual and expressive pursuits such that speaking of a genre is obsolete. Is there any use in even addressing the problem? But I have a more specific formulation of this, which actually gets me going faster. On my own reader response team.
Yeah, go.
Yeah, I'm telling you. If the lyric is so identified with early modernity, is there any role for the lyric 100 years later? What would that look like? And this is where the critical function comes in. That is to say, one answer to myself is, do the metalinguistic gambit. Address those conventions directly, but within the poem. Or, that's non-solution A, as Barrett Watt would say. That's non-solution A. Non-solution B might be just bring two things together and deal with it. Or don't deal with it. Just bring two things together. For instance, Gerard Jeannette's table of contents. Import that into a poem. Which the reason I did that is severalfold. There's a poem online called Tables of Contents or Table of Contents, Cities of the Table, that's what it is, which I will probably continue to worry about and produce more of. The tables of contents, of course, are apparatus. They're supplements to books in certain ways, and yet they legislate in a very pragmatically useful way how we are to read them. In fact, they're little lists or condensed enumerations of some sort corresponding to a narrative. They're very curious entities. I will continue to brood and worry about those as artifactual and cultural entities. And one way I will do it is through non-discursive means, through lyric means. I don't know if I can succeed, but I've given myself that challenge.
So a phrase you use, and I'm going to misquote it, but you were doing some activity in painting, and you were following out to see what would come into being by that act, and I think that naming. I think you used naming. I've got it written down here. I'm reading it anyway, whether you remember this or not. So I guess I'm going to, it's just in a way, to prolong the same question. So you are writing, say, meta-lyric, critical lyric.
I'm trying to do that.
Right.
I'm trying to do that.
Right, and that, and so actually the large genres, poetry, even writing, I mean, have a funny valence. I mean, they're a big question mark or a site of dissatisfaction.
I would say no, that's one way. Mm. That is one way. I am not disputing that. I'm saying, is there another way? Are there other ways? Let us posit or propose something. Let's problematize the issue of genre or something else, some standard configuration, in theoretically interesting ways, and then worry about the solutions later. I mean, in other words, work it out, you know, work it out on the page. I think that's where the studio comes in also. And that's also maybe how the critical voice does not get too dogmatic. If the page becomes a studio or a site of investigation, the rhetoric is more in line with the probing or the research.
We talked last night about various genealogies, and we two possible. If we did an aesthetic DNA test on you, we might get Stein and Stevens. We both of whom, of course, have a lot to do. Are situated in the intersection of writing and painting. But just what you were saying now makes me think of Stein, who you say, well, modernism is identified with the lyric, but in fact, Stein might well be on that same studio page as you, trying to figure out interrogate all manner of generic mm-hmm. boundaries, and that is the activity of writing. I mean, does that seem
right? Let me
but,
say,
but you're not Stein, and your writing isn't quite like Stein. So there's obviously my formulation is too.
No. That's okay. I just wanted to say this. I didn't say it was identified with early modernism, early modernity.
Oh, sorry.
I will. Hilderin.
Don't tell anybody. Whose
name I mispronounced. Hilderin. For instance, it depends.
Yeah.
One thing we can do, I won't avoid the question, but I'm not saying that all of modernity is invested only in the lyric. I'm saying that, but the lyric fragment is a mark of a certain modernity. And this is one thing that we were possibly entertaining too. I sometimes ask, as I did once in an interview of the current curator of 20th century art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, when did modernity begin? That's my test question.
Write it down on a piece of paper.
It's a trick question because But I don't mind giving you the secret, I don't mind, because the secret won't provide you with the answer. It won't provide you with the key, really. I mean, the key, because there are several answers.
Although he had one answer.
And that will be very interesting to hear. There are several answers, and depending on the answer, the narrative is known. His answer was, in 1890, of course.
Okay. And as you told me, he said, everybody knows this.
And I said, well, when I was going to Columbia and studying art history, the key date for modernity in art was 1855 with Courbet's studio, and a certain teacher organized this course around that painting and recursively came back to it to pull out, to extract, draw out, and discuss the implications of that. I said that to him, and he said, well, some people think the modern era began with Napoleon. And I didn't say anything. but in a poem I wrote 10 years after that, I've been sort of carrying an open file on this, I raised that question again. And indeed, there are strong arguments to be made for 1890, for 1848, for approximately 1827, or debatably 1794. And Joseph Maschek makes a very strong case for modernity beginning with the Neolithic, and that everything is a course correction from that point. And I think it's a very interesting position. But indeed, the lyric, of course, is only an expression of a form of, an aspect of a modernity. It can be entailed, or it can be disengaged, unengaged, but it depends on the narrative being invoked, I think.
Does satisfyingly crisp, informative, lively art making, your writing, really depend on being au courant with a narrative that satisfies you? In other words, can how imperious is that sense of narrative of what's plausible to do now or needing to be done now, what has been done and is old hat?
That's a very good question. It's very imperious with me. I worry about it all the time.
And spell out some of the voices that are commanding or the conditions that, you know, are so impinge so powerfully. Specific examples of writers of...
Well, these are old-fashioned terms, but there need not be one narrative, but neither, as Oswaldo Romberg has said, it's not everything goes. That's not an idea. It's not an argument. It's not a thesis. It's nothing. If we do not think in some sense of entailments, if not the terms necessary and sufficient, but if we do not think in terms of some entailments, then we can't use the word ideology. You know, we can't say we have a belief system, in theory or in practice.
A belief system is needed to make art.
There's
a soundbite from Rauschenberg of not knowing what you're doing, etc. Being that's the crucial point.
That's already a belief, which has its genealogy and spontaneity, etc. And actually, he was one of the better instances of someone who misbehaves in an intuitive, very brainy way, or at least very early on. He's produced some, maybe half dozen theoretically important counterexamples that have changed, that have helped a narrative in history. So he gets the right to say silly things like that.
Okay.
But I don't have an answer for you. I can only say I think of what is entailed in certain significant ways. I can say this, you know enough about me by now to know some of my biases and prejudices. Certain kinds of narratives have been built on technologies. Certain kinds of narratives have been rationalized through language. Certain kinds of cultural paradigms have been made manifest through the fruitful animosity that goes on between history and theory. You know, as I still think they are valid key terms, speaking of key terms, to warrant thinking with. I might want to, for instance, in dialogue with somebody, say, let us posit two or three terms, or three terms where we had two. What would that third term be? Do we understand enough to know what that third term would be for this binary? What would be an art then for that? In other words, I would produce little models, little thought forms, having to do with possible paradigms from a certain kind of nexus. One reason I was sort of badgering the series and the poems that have come about is that to me that's one of the, that they're more than motifs, they're objects. And that they stand in for many worlds, they stand in for worlds. I'm not speaking coherently. I've been thinking in series and incorporating also series into other poems like Point, Line, Plane, Red, Yellow, and Blue as a more fruitful way of thinking about objects, not in terms of their material properties, but their cultural properties. The object being not the thing that has a morphology or that can be traded or that ends up in museums, but indeed those objects, which do indeed have material form, are actually text, as we used to say. They're actually culturally very rich, and I was thinking that the series might get at the notion of the object in a better way than one word would.
Thinking of getting you that water.
Okay.
But I guess, okay, how about, let's see if these two terms are get you going. You were saying that criticality is a crucial term for you. Criticality in poetry, criticality in painting. How do you relate that, the critical, to the pedagogic? It seems to me that they could be opposed very easily, that the criticality is often, you know, would be debunking the sense of some sort of perceptual shock or invigorating shock, as opposed to the pedagogic. Are you?
I'm tempted to say you're very kind in presenting and being the straw man for that question, since you have a lot of thoughtful things to say on that yourself, and I'd be interested to hear what you have to say. But I'll give it a whack.
You interview me.
No, I'll give it a.
And now I'm interviewing you.
No, I'll give it a whack, but then you go.
Okay.
When I teach this stuff, I teach the critical in some of the following senses. That is to say, a philosophical sense of that is the investigative rather than the advocacy mode, the investigation rather than the advocacy that's at stake here. That criticality is also, and this is taken from a philosophical dictionary on the term critical, a clarification of terms that might be obscure, ambiguous, or paradoxical. I'm not saying this is the only kind of criticality, but I'm getting at something here. that the agent or the person who is being critical can have a position, can hold a position, but he or she treats his position with the same scrutiny that he would treat others' positions. Therein lies an objectivity. In other words, the subjectivity is acknowledged. The subjectivity is made articulate enough so that the self-critical is not parodic. That's my outflanking maneuver to the parodic, or the infinite regress of framing, or the infinite regress of I know this had a weakness, or I know that now that the XYZ invention has been mismanaged, all of technology is sick. I don't think that's a critical position.
Well, I guess I was trying to ask a slightly more intimate question about criticality and the pedagogic, not you as a teacher and all the good faith or whatever faith compromises and things we go through to get the paycheck in the classroom, but it seems to me a primary flavor in your poetry is that of a very incisive criticality. So a poem that I was going to...
What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm saying I was going to ask you, I'm getting around also to asking you to read a poem because it strikes me as that would be, you know, a very good thing to do at this moment. But the else in substance, it's in my hand. Yes, okay, here. The way you present in a line, in a couplet, you present something and then immediately you critique it. That's, in a way, the next move. You know, the dress, the other dress, and as Keith was saying, you think you know the rules of this poem by this fifth couplet. You don't know the rules of this poem. So that if that's what I guess I'm using the term critical to describe that mode of activity, as opposed to the pedagogic that, you know, gratis ad parnassum, you do Czerny and then you do Chopin, first you know this, then having known this, now I can show you something more complicated. I'm wondering if that has any place in your writing. It seems that those are rather antithetical.
I don't know that I can answer the
Maybe
question.
You can answer.
Well, what I mean is, I don't quite know what you mean by critical. You went from the saying critical to an exemplification,
yes.
So I can't say I understand you. But if you mean rumination or speculation, or if you mean...
That the temporary gestalt or frame that the reader gets, the next thing that happens is revise that. That frame needs to be expanded. Certainly, it's don't think you've got it. So that kind of motion, mm-hmm. which is a it doesn't work as a pedagogic.
Why isn't that formal composition, as in logic or as in alogic? Formal meaning you've made this move. What is your response to this move? If you are interested in the implications, consequences, or entertain, you know, now I've done this, what is the implication of that? What are the possibilities? I can go here, I can go here, I can do this, I can do that. That seems, you know, and the critical might impinge on the notion of probabilities in poetry, where it is advantageous in that game that's called the lyric to make moves that are interesting or stimulating or significant. That then could stand in for the critical. I don't know.
I didn't. I was following you until
the end.
No, until the end. Because I was going to say about when you said, well, isn't it just the formal? I was going to say at that point, you're describing a dialogic situation where form is dynamic, it's in process, so that I guess I'm really getting around to asking you to read this, and
I'll
we
read
can
it.
Talk about this
okay.
as you have read it, if it still
yeah.
continues to resonate. If it were a painting, it would stay permanent.
Well,
if it's a poem, it's going to be evident.
Keith read it, but I'll
because
I'll
it also
see
is
if
interesting
I can
about the lyric, the dress, you know.
Well, indeed, but this poem indeed began with a mini strategy. I remember thinking to myself, how funny, it's my sense of humor, how funny the couplet, logically the couplet is the dress, the other dress, they're incommensurate because culturally, well, the culturally it means something and logically it means something else. I thought that was hilarious.
Wait, say that again.
Nothing.
No.
Forget it. I'm going to
read
it.
I'll look it up on the tape.
I'll read it. Else in substance. The dress, the other dress. The recurrent dress, the perpetual dress. The basic dress, the reductive dress. The little dress, the little black dress. The opaque dress, the remote dress. The opaque dress, the mute dress. Reply that, rhetorical dress, happens frequently, happens sufficiently, in explicit instances, in the works of X. The dress, the other dress. The necessary dress, the contingent dress. For the thesis that, realizing the ideal cannot be in objects such as these, lexicons not self-identical, as of forgetful Greece, say again in memoriam, happens always, frequently, in prophetic dress of explicit instances, Helen merely a limiting case. Missing mass is entailed dress for the repudiating career. The belles lettres dress, the situationist dress, the meaningless dress, the meaninglessness of dress, the dress, the other dress, propositional and repudiating aftermath, a dress, a blank space designating the loan to a museum elsewhere and the loan, plausibly, to here. The dress an estimate, a dress explained. The explained dress contemporary. The interpreted winter dress. The dress, the idea of a dress. Interpreting where, interpreting water, else, passum, intuitions, either or, and one-eighth, without dress, throughout dress.
Dare I say it? That's so beautiful. I shouldn't say that.
You're forgiven.
Yeah. Should, I think
we should
past
end.
Time,
yeah.
We're beyond modernity into...
into afternoon.
Yeah.
Thank you very, very, very much.